this talk was actually originally scheduled for 2 weeks ago, but there was another. There was a meeting on a very similar topic that was held on scientific fraud, so I was pushed back. I've managed over my time here to attend a few of these now, and I don't have no idea what they're for, these Blackboard, or who they're, or how to do them, these Blackboard talks. It seems to me they're sort of pedagogical talks, because they're for everyone, but without data or pictures, because you can't have PowerPoint. So that's perfect for string theory. But cosmology is mostly data and pictures, and a little bit of theory. And so I was a little hesitant about what to talk about. The two organizers who asked me, Mark Kamienkowski asked me, and then Martin picked this title, and they're both gone, so I was going to change it. But I thought I would try and do and give a review using equations, which is the point of this, I suppose, on what the issues are regarding lambda, and try and talk about some current research. But this is probably more directed at the condensed matter people than the cosmology people. So first of all, I purposely left it a little vague. I don't know exactly whether I want to talk about lambda or something else. I just want to remind everyone first why we shouldn't believe in lambda, so everyone's on the same wavelength. So quantum field theory tells us that the vacuum has an infinite number of harmonic oscillators in it, and if we go to infinite frequencies, that means the vacuum has infinite energy. That's no problem, because you can subtract that away in all areas except for gravity, which depends not just on energy differences, but net absolute energy. So normally in quantum field theory, we throw out this piece and subtract it from all of our calculations. But in gravity, one has to worry about what the absolute energy is, because all energy gravitates. Presumably, all energy gravitates, including vacuum energy. So one normally cuts this off at some scale where maybe you figure quantum field theory breaks down or something new happens, like the Planck scale. And then in quantum field theory, you replace these sums by integrals, and dimensionally, that of course just becomes the Planck mass to the fourth power. So that's the canonical value for the vacuum energy that you would expect in quantum field theory. If somehow quantum field theory breaks down at the Planck scale and something cuts off all quantum fluctuations at scales larger than that. And that, of course, is the origin of why one never believed in lambda, because that value of that is approximately 10 to the 123 times the critical density today. And so the idea is, this number in some set of units is something like 10 to the minus 30 grams per cubic centimeters, or I think 10 to the minus 47 GeV to the fourth power in a more appropriate set of units. So this is the problem. This is why it's ridiculous to believe in lambda, because the natural value of lambda is 123 orders of magnitude larger than the energy of everything we see. And so therefore, for all the time, most of the time I was a student, and since then, one has assumed lambda is zero, because one can't figure out a way to cut off the scale, cut off quantum fluctuations at a scale which would cancel this to 123 orders of magnitude, but not make it zero. And so if anyone had such a mechanism, then that wouldn't be a problem. But that this naturalness problem of trying to cancel something off for everything until the 123rd decimal place is one reason why people have always assumed it's zero. Now, there's another problem, and that's the coincidence problem as well, which is, okay, let's say lambda is non-zero today and observable. There's a problem. So the vacuum energy density, Lorentz invariance tells you that, it doesn't matter what I do here, that the only form that vacuum energy can have is this, because the only tensor that you can have, and if nothing else, is the metric, and therefore the vacuum energy has that form, and for an isotropic universe, that we know that this is sort of p or rho minus P, it's a diagonal. Minus P, minus P, minus P. And that tells you that for vacuum energy, P is minus rho. Now, most of the fundamental equations in cosmology are really come from thermodynamics. And the central one is that D equals P dV. Okay? So you can determine for an expanding universe how things evolve given their pressure. And one could just rewrite this as ddr as a scale factor, rho r cubed equals minus 3 p r squared. And then just solving that, that tells you that rho equals, goes like r to the minus 3 times 1 plus w, or omega, depending upon what you like to call this word, w, I'll call it w, is p over rho, which is the equation of state parameter. So any material evolves as the universe expands depends upon its equation of state this way. And this is quite clear. It gives you all the familiar results you know of. You know for matter, for matter, which is non-relativistic, P is zero, and matter just redshifts like 1 over the volume, gets less dense. For radiation, where P equals 1/3 rho, this goes r to the minus 4. So radiation, not only do the number density of photons decrease as the volume, but the energy of each photon decreases with redshift, so you get one extra factor of redshift. But you see, for something that has pressure equal to minus rho, then that plugging this in here, W is minus 1, this is 0. And that means that vacuum energy density can't redshift. And that's miserable, because it gives this famous coincidence problem. Namely, if you take the energy density of anything, say, as the universe expands, matter goes as r to the minus 3, radiation goes as r to the minus 4, but vacuum energy density remains constant. And so the question is, if these are comparable today, why today? Because for all times earlier in the history of the universe, the vacuum energy would have been irrelevant. And all times in the future of the universe, if we have vacuum energy, it will be dominant. So why would the two things be comparable when the universe is 10 to the 10th years old? It's just ridiculous. So there are two sort of naturalness problems. One, the overall value of lambda. And two, the fact that it's ridiculous to imagine that these things would be comparable today at a time which is no special time in the history of the universe. It's not the Planck time. It's not some canonical time. It's just today. So these are the reasons not to believe in the cosmos, in lambda. Okay. So now I want to give the why we believe in lambda. And I want to review the observations in the order that I like to take them. And then I'll come back if we have time, and hopefully won't have time, to talk about whether we have lambda or something else. Of course, if you read where people publish, which is the New York Times, you'll discover that the reason we believe in lambda is that the universe is accelerating. But I think, and that's certainly what caught people's attention, but I think there are factors that make it pretty hard to get around that that conclusion without that. But I'll talk about that result too. The first thing it seems to that the first reason that we believe in lambda is that omega matter is much, much less than 1. Everyone knows what omega is. Omega for any species I, is the ratio of its energy density over the critical density, which would result in a flat universe. And so omega matter is much, much less than 1. And by less, much, much less than 1, I mean a factor of 3 less than 1. And but that's been used many. 3 is a large number in many cases. Now, that's a problem right away. And I remind you, one of the reasons it's a problem is that, and this is a theoretical reason, not an observational one, is that this is a dynamical quantity in any universe it goes like this, where this is the Hubble constant. And the Hubble constant squared is related to the energy density of stuff. Okay? And therefore, in a matter-dominated universe, this goes like like r cubed, and 1 over r cubed. And therefore, this goes like r in a matter-dominated universe. In a radiation-dominated universe, this goes like r to the 4th, r to the minus 4, and therefore this goes like r squared in a radiation-dominated universe. Okay? So the fact that omega, this has been well known, this is the famous flatness problem, the fact that omega is close to 1 today is inexplicable, because that means at any earlier time it was much, much closer to 1. And since it is driven away from 1, unless it was fine-tuned to be very, 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 very close to 1, it would be very, very far away from 1 now. And so theorists have a big problem with this already. But of course, that's just a theoretical problem and may be irrelevant. But in the last 5 years or so, it's become, or maybe 7 years, it's become unambiguous that this is a true statement, that omega matter, including dark matter, is much, much less than 1. Anything that clusters due to gravity, that's visible matter, dark matter, anything that is gravitationally attractive, the total energy density of it is far smaller than needed to make the universe flat. And there are a number of ways to do that, and some of it I would show in pictures, and there was some talk of giving a colloquium which I would have had pictures of at some other point. But if I'm not going to show pictures, there's two things I want to mention that give compelling evidence that omega matter is not equal to 1. One comes from X-ray observations of clusters of galaxies. Okay, so a cluster of galaxies in pictures looks like a bunch of galaxies, little dots here. But the dominant stuff in a cluster of galaxies is not the galaxies, it's the hot gas. When you take an X-ray picture, it looks like this. Okay, a lot of hot gas emitting X-rays. Now, if it's roughly spherical, and on average you can look and try and say these things are roughly spherical, these clusters, then you can assume this system is in hydrostatic equilibrium. Okay, that means that sort of the gradient of the pressure is related to the gravitational force. Okay, this is an equation that we use over and over again in different ways in constraining things, the notion of hydrostatic equilibrium. That means if you can measure the X-ray temperature and intensity as a function of radius, since the intensity depends on the number density of particles and the pressure gradient, and the temperature gradient is related to the pressure gradient that is related to the gravitational potential. In principle, if you can measure temperature as a function of radius along with intensity, you can invert that and get the mass of the stuff that's emitting the X-rays, the total mass of gas, because you know the density of stuff, but you can also get the total mass, the gravitational potential that's in. But yet, it depends crucially on this assumption of hydrostatic equilibrium. If the system's in hydrostatic equilibrium from the temperature as a function of radius, you can invert that in principle and get the mass of the gas that's emitting the light, the X-rays, and the total mass. Now, so therefore, you can measure the ratio gas mass over total mass. Now, if almost all baryons are gas, the galaxies are small pollution, then this is approximately, and the other thing is, if these things are the, and I should have said it, these clumps of clusters of galaxies are the largest bound objects in the universe, then they, in principle, should probe anything that can fall into something will fall into them. So the total mass of these systems, one would hope, is a reasonable probe of the total mass of anything that can fall that is gravitationally attractive. So this ratio, which one calls the baryon fraction of these systems, is certainly less than or equal to omega baryon over omega total. This is the fraction of the closure density in baryons over the total. And by total, I mean here total clustered stuff. So this has been measured in lots of galaxies, in lots of clusters. And the point is, it's a number which is less than 1, which is part of the evidence for dark matter. It's a number that's 0.212, I think I got from a most recent survey, plus or minus 0.006. H to the minus 3/2, where H in this case was normalized in the paper I took it from in units
the
of 50.
The errors are really that small.
What?
The errors are really that small.
The stated errors are really that small. It comes from many, many different clusters. Okay? But the point is, You can multiply the errors by a factor of a bunch, and you get something which is still certainly less than 1. Okay? Now, yeah, I mean, I spend endless talks talking about this, but in all of astrophysics, the dominant stuff, you have to worry about a systematic error. So I'm going to talk about that later. But the interesting thing is, therefore, now, what one could do here is we now have a good measurement of the baryon density universe from 2 different independent things. 1 from Big Bang nucleosynthesis, right, Gary?
Right.
Okay. And 2 from cosmic microwave background radiation, which also gives an independent measurement of the baryon density. And the interesting thing about both of those is they agree exactly. Okay? And so it's sort of the omega baryon H squared, where this is in everything in cosmology, the Hubble constant appears because it's the scale of everything. And this is between 0 and 1, depending upon whether the Hubble constant is between 0 and 100 kilometers per second per megaparsec. So this is about 0.02 plus or minus 0.002 is the claim. And it certainly is an agreement at that level. And if you plug this in here, and you bring this up here in this equation, you get that omega total clustered is less than 0.45 H50 to the minus 1/2. So using the baryon, the Big Bang nucleosynthesis baryon density, and the one, and as I say, now cosmic microwave background measurements agree with this, one can get an upper limit on the total omega in clustered stuff. And for H of 75 or so, or 70, this thing is of order 0.35. So one gets an upper bound that the total density of clustered stuff is less than 0.35. It's about a third of what you need to close the universe.
I don't understand what the definition of this cluster is. What is not included in clustered stuff?
Anything that's not in clusters.
It
has to be smoothly distributed. It can't fall into large potential wells. Anything that can fall into the potential well defined by the largest bound objects we know of in the universe would avoid this bound.
So what would be the main component of it?
Vacuum energy, for example.
Okay,
well, aside from that, there's nothing that we know of.
Radiation.
Pure radiation. Pure radiation, yes. Absolutely. Something that's pure radiation wouldn't. People used to think that neutrinos wouldn't if they were light enough. But any neutrino that can be significant for dark matter, in fact, was shown will fall into galaxies. So all dark matter candidates could be relevant to omega would fall into this. Light neutrinos, I mean really light neutrinos, which are essentially radiation, would not. But they would not give a significant component to omega today. Okay, so you might find that a little less than convincing. So I want to give you the other argument that I think has also gotten a lot stronger in the last few years. And it's, again, something one could do on the blackboard. I just tried to think of things you could do with the blackboard.
Art, I'm not sure if you made the connection, at least that some non-cosmologists might have picked up on, and you just erased it.
Good.
The K, the curvature, is 0, or very close to 0.
I'm going to get to that.
Oh, okay.
I promise I'm going to get to that. I mean, that's the whole point.
Otherwise, why do I care whether omega is
exactly
0.35 or
not? I know, but I'm still on part item 1. Okay. But that's a very good point. Okay, but the other argument for why omega clustered is less than 1, it comes from primordial fluctuations. And, of course, this is a topic which one can get into in extreme detail. But the nice thing about it is there's sort of general arguments that depend on knowing very little about details of cosmology that tell you that that suggests that omega matters less than 1. So the idea is, what are primordial fluctuations? What we know, there's clustering in the universe, and we want to know what the primordial fluctuations that led by gravity for those fluctuations to form. And we have ideas for what that would be. But even before we had models that in fact proposed such things, there was an argument that these things should be scale independent. Namely, unless one had a good idea for why there should be some preferred scale at the beginning of time, one instead would say delta rho over rho, if one looked at the Fourier components, delta rho of k over rho, so one expanded this in Fourier modes, that the square of this would be proportional to k to the n.
And that says it's scale independent. There's no preferred scale. Okay, that was an assumption. Now, one, if n is approximately equal to 1, then these are scale invariant. Now, well before inflation, which, by the way, predicts, quote unquote, n to be approximately equal to 1 for most inflationary models, although there are inflationary models that can predict virtually any value of n, which is some people would argue is a problem. But there's a good argument that n can't be very much different than 1. And it's an observational argument. If n is much bigger than 1, then let's see, this blows up for large k. If it blows up for large k, you have huge fluctuations on small scales, large wave numbers, small wavelength. That means you have millions of primordial black holes. You don't see primordial black holes. You see, because you'd eventually get huge fluctuations bigger than 1 on small scales and lots of things. There'd be lots of primordial black holes. You don't see those. If n is much, much less than 1, then this blows up for small k. But we look at the cosmic microwave background, and it's isotropic, and it doesn't look very inhomogeneous on large scales. So it can't be much bigger than 1 or much smaller than 1. So it's approximately, it was already well before inflation assumed to be approximately equal to 1. No.
Oh, because it's
dk. Yeah, well, you have to. If you actually consider you have to consider the mass contained in a density fluctuation. You have to multiply this by some appropriate power of k, and when you normalize it the way I've normalized it, n equal 1 is done. Is this? In any case, the point is, so the primordial fluctuation spectrum. Looks like this as a function of k. But, of course, that's not what one measures. Because there's physics. Okay? And the physics is that large k is small wavelength. Small wavelength means that primordial fluctuation knows it's a fluctuation earlier on in the history of the universe. Okay? Because the horizon is growing with time. And a fluctuation that whose wavelength is larger than the distance light could travel cannot respond, pressure cannot respond in any way, or no microphysics can respond. But so that means large wave numbers come in the horizon early on. But as I erased it already, we know because of the behavior of matter and radiation that if there's one photon in the universe today, at some point, early on in the history of the universe, it would dominate the energy density. Okay? And so early times, you know the universe is radiation dominated. And when the universe is radiation dominated, there's significant pressure. I erased that too, but radiation has significant pressure. And fluctuations which come inside the horizon, the pressure of radiation will respond to the gravity. So those fluctuations want to collapse due to gravity, but pressure will cause them to want to expand and they'll oscillate. But if they're coupled to photons, they'll turn out to dissipate their energy and go away. So what happens is, this spectrum becomes this spectrum. So this becomes this. So that modes that came in the horizon when the universe was radiation dominated have been damped away. And where's the turnover point? The turnover point we'll call k equilibrium. And that's the point where the energy density of matter is approximately equal to the energy density of radiation. And the universe and pressure begins to become insignificant. So this is just based on causality and the nature of the fact that radiation must dominate early on and matter dominates later. But the nice thing about that is that gives you a measurement of the total matter in the universe. Because this the wave number at which corresponds to a moment when the universe became dominated by, or when matter began to be equal to radiation, of course, is going to depend on the total matter density. It turns out to be omega matter h squared. Okay? Now, you also got to remember that to go from wave number to physical size, there's an extra factor of h in here. And that means that effectively, the wave number where this turns around gives you a measurement of the quantity omega h. Okay, so one can look at structure at basically structures today, large scale structure, and try and probe this function, and see where it turns around. And one calls this quantity the shape factor. And there are extra things in here which complicate it, but not by very much, so I won't go into them. But in principle, if you can measure the two-point correlation function of galaxies as a function of angle on the sky, or as a function of the three-dimensional correlation function, if you have redshift information, you can measure the clustering properties of galaxies, and you can look at delta rho over rho as a function of wave number. And that has been done a lot over the years. But in the last few years, with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey and the 2DF survey, which are looking at millions of galaxies, both in angle and in redshift, there are now new numbers coming in. And the Sloan Digital Sky Survey just quoted a number for gamma, this omega H quantity, of 0.14 plus 0.11 minus 0.06. That's from the three-dimensional survey, but they can just, where they take redshifts, but you can look at more galaxies if you just look at angles across the sky, and don't worry about redshifts. And the two-dimensional redshift gives another number for gamma, which is 0.188 plus or minus 0.04. And you can see that, I remind you, this is omega H, and H is probably around 0.7. So when you plug those numbers in, and by the way, I should give 2DF some credit too. 2DF has also done this, although they've taken the H out, and they get a number for omega matter of 0.27 plus or minus 0.06. In agreement with this, when you take out the H factor. And so what you see is that this also tells us that omega matter is between 0.25 and 0.35, in agreement with the X-ray upper limit. So to me, these are the sort of two real fundamental reasons why we now know that omega matter is less than 1. Okay. Now, but as Gary pointed out, we know that omega total is 1. We know it for two reasons. One, the theoretical reason. But two, we know it because of the cosmic wave background. And I don't know how, I'm going to be very brief here because I assume that you people have been burdened with cosmic microwave background talks up the wazoo. But let me just give you the brief argument because, it's doable on a blackboard and it's very powerful because it doesn't depend on any cosmology, any detailed model of cosmology. It's really quite simple. So the cosmic microwave background radiation gives us a picture of what the universe looks like on a surface that's roughly 10 to the 10th more 2 times 10 to the 10th light years away. Photons that are propagating through us from that surface. That surface was created when the universe was 3 times 10 to the 5th years old. Okay, so that's the cosmic microwave background radiation. It's photons that are propagating up to us from a surface with located this distance away from us, created at a time when the universe was this old. Now, that means there should be a characteristic feature on this surface. Namely, points that are separated on this surface by a distance larger than 3 times 10 to the 5th light years on the surface when it was created, larger than 3 times 10 to the 5th light years, are not causally connected with one another. So any microphysics here cannot affect any microphysics here. So pressure can respond to gravity on things of this scale, but not on things of this scale. Okay, so there should be a characteristic feature. Now, you've got to remember that this surface has been expanding. And this, so that this time corresponds to a redshift of 1,000. Okay? So now you have all the numbers you need. So we know this is a surface that's 2 times 10 to the 10th light years in radius, more or less. And therefore, its circumference is roughly 12 times 10 to the 10th light years. We've got a distance across this surface, which is 3 times 10 to the 5th light years, except it's been expanding by a factor of 1,000. So it's 3 times 10 to the 8th light years. And you can ask, what's that? That's approximately 1 over 400. So the angle spanned by such a size should be roughly 1 degree. Okay? So one would expect to see characteristic signature of this causal relationship, the fact that pressure can respond to gravity on this scale but on larger scales at an order 1 degree. Okay? But of course, that depends on curvature, because that calculation assumed a flat universe where light rays go in straight lines as you go back in time. If the universe is open, then light rays diverge as you go back in time. And if the universe is closed, then light rays converge as you go back in time. So you take the same distance, it's going to span different angles depending upon the curvature of the universe. And it will only be 1 degree if we live in a flat universe. And all of the power spectra that you've seen from all of the cosmic microwave background experiments, appropriately normalized, have a peak. And the peak happens at 1 degree. That's what you get when you can't show pictures. Okay? And so the fact that this peak is now very well, the position of this peak is now very well measured, tells you that omega total is 1 to within at least 5%. Maybe 10% if you want to add on systematic uncertainty. It's maybe 0.9 to 1.1. It isn't 0.35.
The microwave background also gives you omega matter.
Yes, and it gives you omega baryon in particular. But the one thing it does without knowing anything about cosmology is the curvature, and that's what I wanted to talk about. The rest you got to worry about, and I don't want to get into details here. Okay, so we now know that omega matter is this. From every measurement, every single measurement of cosmology, I just gave you two, and we now know that omega total is 1 to within 5 or 10% from the cosmic microwave background and from our theoretical prejudice. Whichever is more important to you depends upon who you are. Okay, so the question is, there must be something out there, and it must be 70% of the universe that's not clustered. And, it's not radiation, because we know the density of radiation, it's about 1 part in 10 to the 4th of the closure density. It's not light neutrinos, because by similar arguments, if they're light, we know their energy density is maybe 1% at most of the closure density, so it's something else. How can you determine what it is? Well, what you want to do is you want to measure this equation of state, W. That will tell us, because then we'll know what type of stuff it is, whether it's matter, radiation, or what. Okay. Now, so that's where all of the action is. Okay. And the first action, of course, was before the fact. But the idea is basically that using this equation and just plugging it into Einstein's equation, which relate the expansion rate of the universe to the density, one gets a second order Einstein equation, which tells us how the expansion rate varies in time. And that depends crucially on this quantity W. So that's why one cares about the equation of state, and that's why most of these papers in cosmology talk about W, the equation of state. Now, there are lots of different ways to measure this. And most of them, in one form or another, relate distance to redshift. And that's the observation that was first done in recent times convincingly by supernova measurements. And what you really care about is this quantity dr dz, where r is the coordinate distance out to some object at a redshift z. Now, I don't want to really. I was thinking if I could actually derive it, but I'm not going to. I think I'm not going to do that, except to say, well, we can write maybe to give you an idea for this. I remind you that 1 plus z, the redshift, is the ratio of the size of the observed universe or some region in the observed universe today, compared to the size of the universe at redshift z. Okay, so you can write this as dr dt, dz dt, to the minus 1. Now, looking at this here, you're going to see that dz dt to the minus 1 is going to be, well, is going to have an r 1 over r dot over r in it. And r dot over r is the Hubble factor, h. And I remind you that h squared is proportional to the energy density. So this whole thing is going to be basically proportional to 1 over h, and that's going to be 1 over the energy density, okay? So the 1/2. And so in every formula you see in any of these papers, basically, you're going to see that extra term there. And you can always write, of course, the energy density today, okay, to be the critical energy density times the fraction of the energy density in matter plus the fraction of the energy density in something else Plus, even if the universe has curvature, you can basically say that there's a curvature piece, which is basically 1 minus all the sum of all the other omegas. Now, you know how each of these scales with redshift. This goes as 1 plus z cubed. Some energy density with an equation of state W, goes like 1 plus z to the 3 times 1 plus W. And this happens to go up to as 1 plus z squared, because curvature has a 1 over r squared in it, in Einstein's equation. Okay. The reason I'm giving you that is because I want to show you how to interpret the supernova curves that you're going to see. So supernova measure, the supernova measurements of type 1a supernova try to measure the distance to supernovae as a function of their redshift. Okay? And so there are lots of different distances in cosmology. And the one that you can measure any one you want, there are lots of physical distances, is the luminosity distance, which is defined to be the luminosity of the object divided by 4 pi times the flux that you get when you're observing it. In a flat universe, that would be distance squared. In a flat non-expanding universe, that would be distance squared. In an expanding universe, it turns out to be proportional to the scale factor today squared times R1 squared, where this is the coordinate distance to that object, times 1 plus z squared. So this is what these guys are measuring. And the idea is to try and measure basically this distance versus z. And the point is that this factor is in there tells us something from the equation of state because of this. And so, in fact, the normal integrals you'll see for describing luminosity distance, early in the lecture I would have actually done this, I suppose. The luminosity distance, it turns out, is going to be an integral from 0 to z. And it's going to be, I remind you, proportional to 1 over the density factor, which has this form. And what you'll find out when you actually do it is that this has a 1 plus z squared times 1 plus z times omega matter minus, and this is in the denominator, minus z times 2 plus z times omega, if we have a cosmological constant, times omega cosmological constant, where I put W for a cosmological constant to be minus 1. And all of that is to the 1/2 power, 2z. So the point is that if you didn't have a cosmological, what this factor does is make this thing in the denominator smaller as a function of redshift. That means the integrated distance is larger. So if you plotted distance versus redshift, if there's a cosmological constant, the distance out to a given redshift will be larger than it would otherwise. Now, distance, if we take the log of this, it's called the distance modulus. And people often write this as a difference in magnitudes. And that, when you see the plots, you'll see difference in magnitudes, which is responsible, which is proportional to the log of the distance versus this. And if you have a cosmological constant, this curve should turn up. Turns out if you don't, it turned down. Okay? And so the observations of type 1a supernovae, which I was going to go into, but I'm going a little long, and I think I don't want to talk about too many observables here, but I'll be happy to talk about those if you want and why one should believe them. We're up here. At high redshift, by redshifts of sort of 0.5, 0.2 to 0.5, these numbers appear to be higher than a straight line. So one could, in fact, plot it and, you know, taking out the straight line and making it horizontal, and the data points were up here rather than down here. Not compellingly so, but they were.
And then eventually, because of z cubed, it comes
up. Exactly. I was going to get to that. That's the key point. That it, well, first of all, you can ask what number best fit this. And what number best fit this, if you assume a cosmological constant, is omega matter 0.3 and omega lambda 0.7. This was before the CMB experiments had measured us to be in a flat universe. But it's exactly what you need to reconcile the CMB measurements and all the other measurements of omega matter. So this is one of the reasons why we believe this result, not because of the result itself, because I have to say, and I'll get into the systematic uncertainties of this in a moment. The original result was certainly not believable, in my opinion. I mean, it was interesting, but not compelling. Systematic uncertainties had not been discussed, but the point is, we already knew that we live in a flat universe or shortly thereafterwards, and we already knew there wasn't enough matter, and the only thing you can think of is some uniformly distributed energy density. Now, is it lambda? We'll get to, maybe. But it's something that's uniformly distributed that doesn't fall in to clustered stuff.
Well, now, I think, to be fair, what the supernova data shows is that lambda or something like it equals zero is not acceptable. But there's a degeneracy between omega lambda and omega matter, and you don't get those numbers unless you impose a different kind of constraint.
I think that's a fair statement, Gary. Okay. But, in fact, this is a reasonable implication from this. Now, one of the reasons this was not believable early on is that this is exactly what you'd expect from any other stuff that would cause it. Because what you're saying is that these guys look like they're further away than they would be otherwise. What does it mean to look like you're further away? It means you're fainter. So supernovae are systematically fainter than they would be otherwise. Well, there's lots of ways to make supernova systematically fainter. You've got to believe supernovae are standard candles, and I was going to go into that, but I won't. But one of the clear things is dust. If there's dust in early galaxies, then it's going to make them look fainter. So that was a real worry. And the observers have done a lot of checking and a lot more data that have tended to confirm this number. But interestingly, as David pointed out, the important thing to realize is that this will turn over. Because as I told you earlier, lambda becomes irrelevant in the early universe. And therefore, eventually, it's going to start doing this. And the region over where it turns over depends particularly on the equation of state of the universe, but it's a redshift greater than of order 1, between 1 and 1.7 or so.
Turning over 1 says that they will start getting brighter.
They'll get, because you'll be recognizing deceleration rather than acceleration. And what is interesting is, by looking back at an old photoplate from 1997, this was not part of the supernova search effort, but at least it was an interesting result. They were able to claim to make a reasonable estimate of the brightness of a supernova that they'd seen back in these other photoplates at a distance, a redshift of 1.7. And it fell in here. It fell below the curve. It's huge. It gets you to right above it, but it's certainly, the point is, what you'd expect if you have dust is to have sort of a monotonic increase. It is not compelling, but it is interesting. Probably that's a bit.
Shouldn't you also have radiation?
Yeah, but radiation, radiation is irrelevant until you get to a redshift of 1,000, so I could ignore it. Okay? Or redshift of 10,000. Okay? Anyway, but what you would expect is some monotonic increase. This is certainly not compelling data. What you'd like to see is supernovas that are actually found at this redshift, but it's certainly another piece of evidence for why you believe this result. It isn't up here. Okay?
This crossover is, again, a very direct indication of what a society we live in, because that's pretty close to us.
Yeah. You can think of, we live in a very special time, and you could win millions of dollars by arguing that. Okay. Or you could certainly you could accept money from people who give up millions of dollars if you argue we're living in a very. This appears to mean that we live in a very special time, which is, and since we know we don't live in a very special time, that's part of the problem. Let me just point out, since it's supposed to be current research, I'll try and end with the observations in a minute and then talk a little bit more theory and then give some time for discussion. That a lot of people argue that, so super clearly what you want to be able to do, if you want to do this better, is measure this exactly. Okay? Because hopefully that might be able to give you the equation of state, because you might not believe that omega or W is equal to minus 1, which it is. Okay? So it is equal to minus 1, but we haven't yet discovered that, okay? Now, what you might hope to do is measure the equation of state. The problem is there are lots of problems. First of all, as you measure supernovae out to larger distances, and you try and measure this, your uncertainty magnitude grows. So in fact, some students and I have done a recent work, which I haven't published yet, but which argues that in fact, the best you can do from ground-based observations on delta W is of order 20% or so. The best you can do with supernova data as we now have it. People want to build a supernova telescope, a SNAP telescope to look at 10,000 supernovae. Some people argue that will allow you to measure this better than this, and it probably will allow you to measure it better than this. But other people have argued that there are other observables of distance versus redshift, basically, that are much more sensitive. And one of them, for example, is the number density of galaxies or clusters as a function of redshift. The reason for that is that this depends upon H naught, well, it depends on R of Z squared. And therefore, in principle, it's much more sensitive to this distance redshift relationship than supernovas. And so if you look at the number density of clusters as a function of redshift and just measure them, you get curves that vary greatly depending upon W. And so one of the ways, there are lots of surveys that are looking for rich clusters. One of the new surveys, of course, will be using something called the Sanyeev-Zeldovich effect, which measures the scattering of cosmic microwave background radiation as it goes through a cluster. And therefore, it turns out to be equally significant for clusters of all redshifts, and you can measure lots and lots of clusters. So people are talking about this, and people have argued, although I don't believe it, that you'll be able to get better than 2 to 3%. I think it's 5 to 10% at best on this quantity, using if you can measure tens of thousands of galaxies. Now, I want to mention, the last thing I want to mention is one new piece of data that also convinces me we have something that is like a cosmological constant. And it's also work I've been involved in. And that's the observation that would really originally led a lot of people to think about a cosmological constant, although for the wrong reasons, and that's the age of the universe. I don't think I'm going to show what I prepared. I'm going to give the baby version because you've been listening for 45 minutes or so, and it's sort of. So the baby version is simple, okay? We measure galaxies moving away from us at a certain distance and a velocity, okay? Now, if the universe were not decelerating or accelerating, we could calculate how long it took for this to happen. Most of us could. Because we know these galaxies have traveled a certain distance at a constant velocity that we can measure, and therefore we can invert that complicated equation to calculate the time. Okay? So you get an age of the universe based on this. Now, if the universe is decelerating, then you know the time it took galaxies to get out to that distance has to be less, because those galaxies were once going faster. Okay? So this gives an upper limit on the age of the universe. Measuring the Hubble constant gives an upper limit on the age of the universe if it's decelerating. And I will give you that upper limit. For a flat matter-dominated universe, it turns out this is the age of a flat matter-dominated universe. H is the Hubble constant measured between 0 and 1, and we think is about 0.66. That's why I put this here. And so one gets that the universe should be 10 gig years old, and if it's older, you've got a problem. Now, for many reasons, and you probably heard, and as I say, I'm getting too tired to go into this, one of the ways to also get a limit on the age of the universe is to look at objects within the universe and determine their age. And you can look at the oldest stars in our galaxy and try and determine their age. And that's been a subject of intense interest for many years, and I've been working on it for 5 or 7 myself. And the interesting thing was that early on in the 1980s, the oldest stars in our galaxy were claimed to be between 16 and 20 billion years old. That was a problem. It turns out, by the way, if the universe were open, which we know it isn't, but if the total energy density of the universe were at least the energy density of dark matter, then one would also get an upper limit of about 12.4 gigayears. So it was even a problem for an open universe. Okay? But If the universe is accelerating, you can get around this, because the galaxies were much moving away from us slower than they are now, and you can make the universe much older for a given Hubble constant today. And this was an argument that was given early on for why maybe the cosmological constant was non-zero. Now, it was an incorrect argument because there are lots of systematic uncertainties. This is astrophysics. And but what I want to inform you of is some recent work we've done. We've been trying to estimate the systematic uncertainties and do stellar evolution models using, and then doing Monte Carlo calculations with my colleague Brian Chaboyer, where we basically evolve 4 million stars, but put in the input parameters, having some uncertainty, and run, you know, 4 million different sets of stars, and then try and compare those stars we produce in the computer with the stars you try and measure in globular clusters to determine an age for the globular cluster, but now you get an age with an uncertainty. And that's, I guess, a whole lecture on its own, which I can talk about more if you want to know what the key uncertainties are. But the interesting thing is, we've just, with some new data on the distance to globular clusters and new important information on the helium abundance, the primordial helium abundance of the universe, which is larger than we once thought it was from Big Bang nucleosynthesis, plugging all those things in, one gets a limit that the age of the oldest globular clusters is now greater than, at the 95% confidence level, put it this way, 10.4 gigayears. That's the age of the oldest globular clusters in our galaxy. We can say that with great certainty, we claim, at least 95% certainty. And that includes systematic uncertainty. So I'm claiming 95% is sort of soft, but it's highly likely. And then you have to add how long did it take the galaxy to form, and what's the minimum time the galaxy could have formed in? Well, we think structures form at redshifts certainly less than 7. And that means that there's a minimum of 0.8 gigayears you have to add on to that. And by the way, the best fit for this is 12.6 gigayears, which gives a best fit age of the universe of 13.4 gigayears. And when you plot this on a plot of omega matter versus W, obviously for W minus 1, you get an older universe because the cosmological constant makes the universe older. And you can actually put where the plots are. And they're actually now non-trivial constraints. This is minus 0.3, minus 0.4, minus 0.5, minus 0.6, minus 0.7. Oh, I drew it wrong, but anyway. Minus 0.8, 0.9, 1. And at the 95%, and this is omega matter, so this is omega matter 0.5, 0.4, 0.3, 0.2, you get at the 95% confidence level plots like this, at the 68% confidence level plots like this, saying you have to live in this region. So at the 68% confidence level, W is less than minus 0.7. And the interesting thing is, at the 95% confidence level, even if you have a cosmological constant, you're not allowed to have omega matter bigger than 0.5. The best fit number happens to be right around here. A universe of age 13.4 gigayears is precisely what you'd expect if omega matter was about 0.3 and W is minus 1. So the best fit value is, once again, for a cosmological constant. So that's another, and the reason I want to mention it is that that's sort of the third of the triumvirate of cosmological tests, age, large-scale structure, and cosmic microwave background stuff. And they all of them, every single one now points towards exactly the same thing. So that's why we believe in quote-unquote lambda. Now, why do we believe in lambda in the last 2 minutes? Why do we believe that W is minus 1? Well, we don't. I mean, I do. But it is a subject of intense research among many graduate students, because it's something you can do if you're a graduate student, to try and we have one of the world's experts of it here, Caldwell. Yeah. I know, but way back when you were. And the point is, so maybe W is not equal to minus 1. And the arguments for that are the arguments I gave you at the beginning. Cosmological constant is crazy. It's stupid. It's insane. But of course, the question is, the point is, while it's crazy, stupid, and insane, it's actually predicted. Namely, quantum field theory, the one thing that is unique to all quantum field theories is they predict the vacuum energy density. They get it wrong by a huge factor, but it's there. You know, if you want to have W not be minus 1, you've got some problems. One of them is, and these have been looked at, but one of them is this coincidence problem, which I presented here. Why do we live at a special time? Now, if you make W can't be that different than minus 1 if you want the universe to keep accelerating, okay? And so if it hasn't changed over time, if it's not minus 1, you still got a coincidence problem. Instead of looking like this, you know, like lambda, this is W greater than minus 1. But you still, it only crosses this curve at 1 and only 1 point. So you still got the coincidence problem. Unless you try and do something tricky and try and make W change with time. Okay? And a lot of people have worried about that and tried to do that. But the problem is that basically, the way to make W not equal minus 1 is instead of having a constant vacuum energy density, you have basically a vacuum energy, an energy density stored that's changing with time, as you might have for a scalar field that's rolling down a potential. But if you want it to not roll down the potential very fast by the time the universe is 10 to the 10th years old, the curvature of the potential has got to be pretty damn small. And the characteristic mass associated with those kind of things is 10 to the minus 30 electron volts or smaller. So you've got to have models that do that. So some people would argue, at least I would, that those are at least as ugly as this. But more importantly, it seems to me, most of the models that I think are the most reasonable have W being close to minus 1. And I suspect, unfortunately, that the future is the following, that we'll do very careful measurements, get W, and find it at the level of measurement accuracy indistinguishable from minus 1, which will tell us absolutely nothing. Because, of course, what we really want to do is see it be different than minus 1, because then we know it wasn't a cosmological constant. If it's indistinguishable from minus 1, it doesn't tell us anything. It doesn't give us any information. And that's, I think, what's going to happen. Thank you.
Sorry, counting you for an optimistic.
Yeah.
So cosmology will be one part of it.
It could be that the golden era is, I won't say it, anyway.
Any questions?
Yeah?
This isn't a question. Can this workshop please come up with a decent name for W other than equation of state parameter, which takes forever to say?
I think the Krauss parameter sounds pretty good.
All those in favor?
Sorry. I think it's good because it the point of this was to interest, you know, condensed matter physicists, and you mentioned equation of state. Is there,
yeah,
you
know what that means.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Any other profound question?
I wonder if you haven't used dark energy, which
yeah,
which
well,
should be called, if anything, dark pressure, because it really comes from the negative pressure.
Well, dark energy is better than the other name, I think, but dark pressure, it'd be better. I think a cosmological constant has a certain ring to it.
did you have a question?
I wanted to advertise a little idea I had a couple of years ago that gives it, in principle, an entirely different way of measuring such things, which is with neutrino flight time effects. That because we now know the neutrino is a small mass, different neutrinos will separate a little bit as they fly to us, and this delay time, if you can get neutrino bursts from cosmological distances, will contain these cosmological parameters. So in principle, I don't know if it's overly practical. There's an entirely different way of checking all this stuff.
Or you may have the delay of the neutrinos and the light.
Or two neutrinos of different masses.
Lower neutrinos. That'll probably, well, at present, it's probably limited by models of exploding stars. Maybe that would get sufficiently well controlled that you could separate the effects.
Well, it's probably more limited by our ability to detect them, right?
Well, that's
because from cosmological distances, unless they have very high energies, it's pretty hard to detect them. And if they have very high energies, like cosmic ray neutrinos, then the mass effect is going to be very small.
Mm-hmm. Your cautions about systematics, I think, are very well taken. And you've also implied that one can get equation of state through more than one method, so one has complementarity, which is one of the ways of getting the high precision. You have orthogonal methods, and that allows you to get W more precisely. And also wanted to correct one small thing on the supernova diagram. You mentioned dust. All dust that we've ever seen that we know about physically have already been taken out, and that requires some dust that nobody's ever seen. Yeah. Only theorized.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what I did subtly say that. The observers, since the original discovery, but I don't believe at the time of the original quote discovery, have tried to examine all different dust models and argued that they can't reproduce the data. But I think that's post the claim. But that's history. But I think it's absolutely important that they've looked at every kind of dust model you can have and it can't reproduce it.
So what is the crucial observation we're waiting for, this turnover in the brightness curve?
Well, that would be, the interesting thing is, that's a crucial observation in terms of getting rid of systematics, but it doesn't tell you W. It just tells you that what we already believe. I told you already, I already believe that there's a cosmology, we believe in lambda. So it'll just confirm our belief. But it won't necessarily give you W very accurately, any more accurately than the present existing complementary constraints have given. You know, we already know it to maybe 20 to 30%. I don't know whether you'd say.
If you give up all modeling, mm-hmm. and W could be any function of Z, and this, obviously, the farther out you go, constrains W. Cost minus
it,
one,
it does,
Z,
if you,
something
it,
shooting up.
But it turns out, actually, what we've done in our paper with this in this work is, if you get rid of all modeling, if you don't know whether W gets bigger or smaller, the way you apply these things are very, very different, it turns out. And by the way, the other thing I should have said is, we don't know that W is greater than minus one. Only, I would love, David, for a good argument, a firm argument for why W has to be greater than minus one. I mean, if it's less than minus one, the energy density increases with time. But is that ruled out by quantum field theory in any sense? Interestingly enough, I don't know of any general argument that would rule it out. So we don't know if it's negative. And that, by the way, that's something interesting because I thought we could use the age of the universe to get a constraint on make W, because the universe gets older and older and older as you make this less and less. But it turns out it doesn't. And the reason is that, I didn't write it down, but because I didn't get to that point, that it turns out that there are two pieces in terms of the age of the universe. There's matter and there's this extra stuff. And as you get this extra stuff and give it a higher, more and more negative value of W, it becomes more and more relevant more quickly. And there's actually a practical upper limit I've calculated for all values of W of about 20 billion years. And unfortunately, our upper limit from the our current measurements of the age of galactic clusters is 20 billion years. So we can limit W to less than minus 600 or something like that, but nothing significant. So it would be nice to have a theoretical argument, because we don't know anything about this quantity. We don't know if it's constant. We don't know if it's bigger than minus one. And that means the kind of strategies you want to use to detect depend crucially on some modeling. And they're very, very different if W is getting more negative with time or less negative with time. And I know I've heard equally plausible reasons for why it should do one or the other. I mean, equally implausible, let me put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Do any of the models with the Krauss parameter equal to minus one actually explain the coincidence problem?
You mean with a cosmological constant? Does anyone... With W minus one, it's a cosmological constant,
yeah.
Or essentially close to it. And people have tried to argue that, but those models tend... The models that try and explain the coincidence problem, and you can correct me, I'm sure you will if I'm wrong, tend to predict W being greater than minus 0.7. And that tend to. The ones that are called tracking solutions, which try and... Mm-hmm. And those tend to be ruled out by the present observations. And that's not a theorem, but it just... It's easier to do that if you have W being further away from minus 1. The closer it gets to minus 1, the harder it is to explain the coincidence problem, I think. Is that a fair statement?
Sure. I think it's early days to start moving things out.
Yeah, but it's just a tendency.
I mean, W could vary with time also.
Exactly. And if it isn't minus 1, it probably does vary with time.
Okay?
Because the equation of state of matter does, in some sense. Matter starts out hot and gets cold. It starts out of radiation and becomes matter. So, and again, if it's not minus 1, you expect it. The simplest model is it's in a potential that's rolling. It starts to roll. W is a ratio of the potential, it's related to ratio of the kinetic energy to the potential energy. It starts to roll, that ratio changes.
You said we're going to find out that W is near to 1 to magnetic. How are we going to find this out? What observations?
Well, we'll measure 10,000 or 100,000 supernovae. We'll measure 100,000 clusters as a function of redshift.
There's another way that the Columbia Group, Arlen Crotz's, if you look at a spherical object at high redshift, and depending on the volume, that spherical object can be squashed. So
that's the Alcock-Pachinsky
test.
Yeah, there's a lot of different tests that all try and do the same thing.
So and that he expects to have some data a year from now, to which he hopes will tell you is lambda zero or not. And then as he's looking at actually the sphericity of Lyman alpha lines, some kind of statistical arguments, and so he needs a lot of quasars to get more information than that, and that'll take, I don't know, Sloan quasars or something. But so a year from now, he'll have something.
But there'll be some data. Now, if you get a 10% accuracy in W, if W is minus 0.5, you're fine. If it's minus 0.75, but it's minus 0.8.5 or 0.9 or 0.95, you're not fine in terms of being able to distinguish from minus 1. And I said, hey, since we already know from observations it's probably less than minus 0.7, it's going to be hard, although not impossible, to get the kind of accuracy one needs. And my bet is, since it's probably going to be pretty close to minus 1, there won't be a test of distinction.
The only test that I know that doesn't rely on a standard candle is the Alcock-Pachinsky.
Yeah,
but that's extremely insensitive to W between redshifts of 2 and 3.
Yeah.
You've got a crossover of two effects, and W basically cancels out. You learn a lot about omega matter that way.
But you don't learn. It's true. It's hard to imagine how you're going to constrain it. You'll get better and better, but I'm willing to bet anyone in this room that you won't. While David is head of the Center for the Institute of Theoretical Physics, we won't know W is different than minus 1.
Let me advertise SNAP a little bit here. Looking at the time variation of W, even if you get that the value of W is minus 1, but you find a time variation, it tells you it's not a cosmological constant.
Yeah, if you can really accurately know, see a time variation.
And SNAP together with Planck gives you 99% confidence.
I think with
decent
information on omega matter, I think you're going to get that.
Right.
Maybe.
That's
it will be nice.
Although actually SNAP plus Planck, even if you don't know omega matter, you get 99% confidence level limit on if W prime is zero or not.
Okay. By the way, since it's a theory talk, let me close with my final theory.
And what is zero or not within what number?
Right, so it depends what model you assume. So assuming one of the ones put up around a supergravity-inspired model, which predicts a W prime of 0.3, so you can determine that it's 0.3, W prime of 0.3, separate from zero at 99% confidence.
So 0.3 is a time scale.
I mean, it's 30% variation over, is that what you mean?
DW over 30%.
So that's changed by 30%.
Over
redshift of 1.
Delta Z of 1 or so.
And that's why I don't believe that's going to be the kind of thing that the theory is going to predict. And in fact, my basic argument, it seems to me.
What is the supergravity?
This is a Braxton-Martin model. It's basically an inverse power law potential multiplied by an e to the q squared, a supergravity cutoff.
Bottom line, it seems to me, is that if W really is in a scalar field, if this energy density really is a scalar field that's changing, mm-hmm. if it's going to weigh 10 to the 10th years, it seems to me that it's just likely going to weigh 10 to the 10th to the 10th years. And someone has to convince me that's not a naturalness problem, that you would expect W to be noticeably changing after 10 to the 10th years. But it could be. We could be lucky. My bet is we're going to be unlucky, and we'll see. I hope I'm wrong.
Okay, that's fine.